The joint session of the 60th Wyoming Legislature budget session will please come to order. Senator Cole, Representative Buchanan, and Goggles will escort the First Lady of Wyoming, Nancy Friedenthal, and their daughter, Katie Friedenthal, and His Excellency, the Governor of the State of Wyoming, Dave Friedenthal, to this joint session. The body will be at ease until the sound of the gavel. The joint session will now come to order.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, it is my pleasure to announce the following guests. The Honorable Clarence A. Brimmer, United States District Judge for the District of Wyoming, escorted by Senator Larson and Representatives Lubnow and Gingrey. The Honorable Michael Golden, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Ross and Representatives Shepperson and Patton. The Honorable William Hill, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Schiffer and Representative Harshman and Carson. The Honorable Marilyn Kite, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Sessions, Representatives Throne and Teeters. The Honorable James Burke, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Perkins and Representatives Peasley and Illaway. The Honorable James Jim McBride, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, escorted by Senator Scott and Representatives McComey and Edmonds. The Honorable Joe Meyer, State Treasurer, escorted by Senator Massey and Representatives Harvey and Hammonds. The Honorable Rita Meyer, State Auditor, escorted by Senator Landon and Representatives Moniz and Wallace. The Honorable Max Maxfield, Secretary of State, escorted by Senator Dockstader and Representatives Bonner and Byrd. The Honorable Barton Voigt, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Wyoming, escorted by Senator Burns and Representatives Landon and Kimball. the First Lady of Wyoming, Nancy Friedenthal, their daughter Katie Friedenthal, and His Excellency, the Governor of the State of Wyoming, Dave Friedenthal, escorted by Senator Coe and Representatives Buchanan and Goggles.
What do you think you're doing? You're supposed to walk all the way up there.
I would like to invite Father Thomas Crockleton to give the invocation.
Let us pray. Almighty and eternal God, in 6 days you created the universe, and on the seventh day you rested. Before you rested, you created human beings, and you gave us dominion over all creation and a sharing in your power of governance. As we begin this budget session of the 60th Wyoming Legislature, we have before us just 20 days to do the great work of the people of this great state. While our task is not as great as the one you accomplished in 6 days, we have much to do in the days before us, and not near the power behind your almighty hand. We ask, therefore, that you pour forth your divine assistance upon our governor, our secretary of state, our auditor, our treasurer, our superintendent of public instruction, the members of our judiciary, the members of our House and Senate, and all their support staffs. King Solomon, when he began his rule, prayed not for power, nor for wealth, nor for a long and healthy life, but rather he prayed for the wisdom to govern and act wisely. Grant our leaders the heart of Solomon. Give unto them the same gift of wisdom to govern and act wisely, particularly when they face the difficult decisions that lie ahead in this session. Help them to work for the common good of the people of this great state of Wyoming, and let them have a special concern for the poor and most disadvantaged in our land. Lord, we also ask that you continue to be with and to watch over and protect the members of the Wyoming National Guard who are deployed and in harm's way. Please also look after all members of our family and friends in the armed services who are abroad and in combat. Keep them safe and make their mission successful and return them to us quickly. We ask this in all things in your holy name.
Members of the 60th Legislature, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I present His Excellency, the Governor of the State of Wyoming, Dave Friedenthal.
Thank you. Thank you. Please be seated. Thank you.
Good morning to the members of the 60th Legislature. Special acknowledgement to Mr. President, Mr. Speaker. Also to the Chief Justice and the members of the Wyoming Judiciary. But most of all, we extend a greeting to the citizens of Wyoming. For in fact, we are in the People's House, as I am often reminded by the members of this House of Representatives. It is unclear to me what title that leaves for the Senate, but I will leave for the two of you to sort that out. I have some suggestions, none of which I'll offer. The opening prayer is appropriate in that it recognizes that we are in Wyoming in a circumstance where we have the largest deployment of Wyoming Army National Guard people in our state's history. In 2009, I had the honor to visit a number of those troops in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Kuwait, and we should be very proud. It was a wonderful trip, accompanied by three other governors, and at the various stops, particularly a couple that were notable for Wyoming, our troops provided the briefing, our troops provided the guidance and the instruction for this delegation of governors, and I will tell you that it makes you proud to be there and to see the fine men and women in our Guard. They are doing a remarkable job. The Air National Guard, while not at the same level of deployment, continues an active deployment throughout the world, particularly in support of the various missions in the Mideast, and they are active and busy. As you know, the Air Guard has a limited time. They're not gone for a year, the way that the Army Guard is, but they are gone much more often. The record of number of deployments for Wyoming Air and Army Guard is an amazing testament to the dedication and the fidelity to this great country that our men and women in the Guard have. We are delighted by that. I'm also delighted to tell you that some years ago when you created the Military Assistance Trust Fund, there was some skepticism about its appropriateness. And I remember a long and arduous path before it was established with uniform support in this body. That fund has given approximately $1.9 million over the last few years to family members in the seven active duty reserve and National Guard branches. It's working, and it's working well, and there's a report available if you want to know how it was spent, but I will tell you it is one of those things that makes a difference for the men and women who continue to volunteer to protect this country, and it is the least that we can do to continue that. I also want to point out that we have remarkable employers in this state. As you know, they confront a great deal of disruption when the men and women who are in their employ either volunteer or are called up and find themselves away from the workplace. Our employers, by and large, with some exceptions, have been incredibly considerate and supportive of the men and women in the Guard. And more than 400 Wyoming employers have been recognized with what's called the Patriot Award, which is a recognition that goes to employers who have been particularly loyal to their employees while they are deployed. And I believe that if you get a chance and you see one of those certificates hanging in an employer's place of business, make sure you thank them. Make sure that you tell them that it is appreciated. We do not want to have our men and women deployed overseas worrying about whether or not they have a job when they come home. These employers perform a remarkable function. In attendance today, we have the Adjutant General, Major General Ed Wright, who has done a remarkable job in leading the efforts to prepare our troops. Major General, where are you? There you are. We're also joined, representing Wyoming's Air Guard, by Staff Sergeant John Estes of the 153rd Civil Engineers Squadron and his wife, Mandy Estes. Staff Sergeant Estes is a firefighter recently returned from Iraq. Also in the audience is his civilian employer, Dan Tenney. Please recognize them. As you know, you cannot recognize the Air Guard without recognizing the Army Guard. And so we have here representing the Wyoming's Army National Guard, Staff Sergeant Jessica Langrick, who is home on leave from the 115th Fire Brigade deployment in Kuwait, a unit which I visited when I was overseas. Also, First Sergeant William Motley is here representing Army National Guard spouses. His wife, Rebecca, is currently deployed with Sergeant Langrick. Please give them recognition. As I noted earlier, we have dedicated employers in this state. Not the least of those are those involved in law enforcement and public safety. As most of you probably know from your own community, an awful lot of the folks, the men and women who are in the Guard, either Air or Army, are also involved in either law enforcement, EMT, or our firefighters in your local community. The most significant of those that tends to stand out right now is that 9 members of Natrona County Sheriff Mark Benton's staff have been deployed with the brigade, and they are not back yet. But we have here to accept recognition on behalf of law enforcement and the emergency responders is the Executive Director of the Wyoming Sheriffs and Chiefs Association, Byron Odekoven. Byron? I would note for the record that we all applaud Byron because he's no longer able to give us tickets in Campbell County when we drive through, so we're delighted you're here. I also would note for the record that there have been the passing of many great leaders in this last year, and one of the things that we all have gathered for over this past year have been funerals of our friends, our leaders, and the people who we would come to admire in this state. I think that we have benefited much by their collective wisdom, and I ask that you keep their families in your prayers going forward. We also have a number of legislators, a couple of new ones, a couple who have moved from the House to the Senate, and it's always an interesting transition to watch to see how that transition goes forward. But I would note in passing that those changes have occurred, and we look forward to working with the new legislators as well as watching the transition from the lower house to the upper house on the part of some of the members. I note that Senator Myers, you're allowed to sit in the front now that you're in the Senate. A very august seating, I would say. As you know, we are gathered here for a budget session. Budget session is that time set aside by our state law for us to consider a budget to be adopted to govern the 2 years commencing in the summer of this year. The purpose of this session is to look at the budget first, and then there are a significant number of other items to approach. I encourage you, as we think about this budget, that there are many reasons for this state to remain fiscally conservative. And I say this at the outset, because it will be a couple of threshold decisions that will be made by the Senate and by the House that will govern the discussions with regard to the budget, namely the decision of whether or not you decide to go into the savings which we have set aside. As you know, the budget that I submitted did not go into the savings that have been set aside, and in fact, the budget adopted by the Appropriations Committee largely observes that standard, with the exception of $20 million that they took out of a savings account, which they said wasn't really a savings account, but if you look at it closely, it was a savings account. But it is not, doesn't do that much damage. But we need to be careful. And one of the reasons is that this business about deleveraging, as is discussed in the periodicals and in the newspapers, is going to continue. And it's going to continue in a way that will continue to affect the availability of credit. And this will be felt on Main Street throughout this country and will continue. I do not see a dramatic change that suggests that this is going to be some aggressive and robust recovery. I believe that it is going to be slow, it is going to be difficult, and part of it is simply the absence of credit availability, particularly for small businesses, and not a matter that I see being resolved very quickly. So the state should remain, I believe, fairly conservative. The second reason is that the national economic news, while relatively encouraging from time to time, is incredibly inconsistent. If you know, if you've watched the market's performance, market for a while, people were saying, you know, we're going to get over 11,000. The next thing you know, we're back under 10,000. If you watch the news, it is inconsistent, and it is difficult to glean exactly which direction and at what rate this economy is going. I hope it does not turn into a double-dip recession, and I think we have reason to believe that it will not. But in the absence of assurance that it will not, I would encourage us to be very careful. I have people who approach me in and out of my office, and I know that you're hearing the same issues, saying, look, Governor, you got about somewhere between $800 million and $1 billion in reserves. We ought to go and spend that state money. I've got a project that needs to be funded, and we need to step in and just put the money out. The Appropriations Committee heard all of those stories right after they finished with me. After the Appropriations Committee took their actions, then they moved on to you as individual members, and particularly to the Speaker and to the Senate President. I simply cannot support that position. And I would encourage you, when people say, all right, the government needs to spend the reserves, ask them how they are managing their own finances. And if they are prepared to bet their house, their savings, and their livelihood on the very gamble that they're asking us to take with the state's future. I encourage you not to go into the legislative, into the LSRA. Stay out of that. I know that there's some other money that can be moved around to meet the needs that you may feel most passionately about. Remember that we're only going to be under this budget for about 6 months before we gather again in Cheyenne. 6 months. It is not so much time in a two-year budget that it cannot be addressed if the need is urgent, that it cannot be addressed in the next session. So I encourage you not to do that. The third reason that we need to be conservative is to take your cue from the private sector. Some of you are actually in the private sector and understand that all of those companies have retrenched, and most companies are not talking about a sort of robust economic recovery over the next few years. And in fact, in Wyoming, the recession has arrived later than in some other states. Hopefully it won't be as deep as it has been in other states, but bear in mind that we have the highest unemployment rate that we've had in 26 years. Highest unemployment rate that we've had in 26 years. And you will see that reflected in the social service rules and in the budget. So I encourage you, while we all want to be optimistic, and I am optimistic about the long-term future of this state, I am not prepared to bet our financial future and to dip in deeply into those reserves. I think we need to hold on to them. And I appreciate the fact that the Joint Appropriations Committee adhered to that. I know the pressure they were under. I know the groups that come in, and it is painful. Many people, along with myself in this chamber, spent many years trying to make sure that we had fully funded a lot of programs, whether it's DD or nursing homes or any other number of things. And now we find ourselves in a position where we are saying we're freezing reimbursement rates, we're not able to fund things at the level we wanted. And at that stage, what goes from a plaintive sort of encouragement for us to add funding becomes an acerbic condemnation that somehow we do not care. We do not care about juveniles, or we don't care about people in nursing homes, or we don't care about water projects. And I encourage you to understand that that is the anger of the moment, and that we need to put this budget together based on the proposition that the state needs to look not 2 years down the road, but maybe further. And so I encourage you to follow the lead of the Joint Appropriations Committee. In general, truth is, if you were to this afternoon decide that you wanted to adopt the budget exactly it came out of the Appropriations Committee and go home, I would be just fine signing that budget. Let me repeat that. If you guys wanted to... Just in case you missed it, if you wanted to adopt the budget just as it came out, I'd be glad to sign it. Now, saying that does not mean that there aren't some disagreements. But I want to point out that the reason we're able to have a session in which the budget is going to be a relatively important but probably not the most significant issue are some actions that have been taken over the last few years. First off, last session when you gathered here, you gave the executive branch authority to make budget reductions in your absence. And we exercised that, took out 10%. We also imposed restrictions on the amount of hiring that could go on in state government. And we also moved fairly heavily towards utilizing those kinds of stimulus dollars, which would allow us to defer, frankly, some state spending. Not supplant, but defer state spending. Now, we arrived at that more than a year ago, and thanks to your support for that, and I know that you did not give a specific authorization for the employee freeze, but I also know that you supported it. And I know that without your support, we would not have been able to enforce it, because we've been through this, where the executive branch says we're going to have hiring restrictions, and then every legislator comes in and takes up the cause for their particular agency. You guys did not do that. You supported us in our efforts to reduce employees, and it's been successful, and I thank you for that. this glide path that we were on to make sure that we were careful about expenditures was supplemented by one other thing, which is a long history in this body during this last boom of one-time expenditures. We were very careful if you look back on it. We fully funded Hathaway, fully funded capital construction, fully funded any number of activities, and did not get in a position where we were in debt or where we had obligations extending beyond our capacity to fund it. So we arrive here today, the envy of many states, not by accident, but by a design that many of you here supported and that we implemented. And one other thing has to be noted. The other reason we're in pretty good shape is that since 2003, we have more than doubled the takeaway capacity of natural gas out of this state. And so while you have had a decline in price, yet has been offset by the fact that you have an increase in volume relative to the volume of material of gas that was being sold during the previous declines in this state. And that makes a significant difference. So the efforts of the Pipeline Authority and those who supported it also had a bearing. I believe that the body should be pleased with the consequences of your prior actions. And when other states say, Wyoming's so lucky, I don't think it's so much luck. Hard work makes it look like luck. But I think that this body has done a remarkable job and will continue to do so going forward. Now, having told you how wonderful you are, doesn't mean I'm in complete agreement with what it is that came out of the Appropriations Committee. And so, as is my wont, I want to list a couple of things that I'd like you to reconsider. I do not support the decision by the Appropriations Committee to significantly reduce school capital construction. There are three reasons. One is it's about the only thing that's going to generate jobs in this state for construction is going to be public construction, publicly funded construction over the summer. Second, we're getting some of the most remarkable bids that we have ever seen in terms of school construction. And I also am troubled by the fact that it was accomplished by essentially just dropping four projects off the bottom of the list. Not based on an evaluation of the projects, just sort of, we need to save 50, let's drop them off. Now, the decision of the committee to reduce the overall funding by 8.5% based on changes in construction costs, that's fine with me. It doesn't change the number of projects that we'll be doing. But I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that we have told school districts, if you will play by the rules, not come to the legislature and ask for special bills, we will keep building schools. Suddenly, when we're about halfway through, a little more than halfway through the process, we're beginning to say, not so fast. Let's not quite do what we said we were going to do. I would encourage you not to deviate from the commitment that we made to those districts. CapCon's pretty straightforward in terms of the UW Arts Center, the Travel Center. The one item that I would draw to your attention is this question of the liquor warehouse. At the tail end of the considerations by the Appropriations Committee, they altered the means by which we were going to finance it, and I suspect many of you heard about that. We had suggested a long-term bond payable out of liquor receipts because we're a control state. Appropriations Committee decided to compress that and to essentially cause an increase in the fees from the liquor warehouse to pay it off at a quicker rate. It was not saying that we weren't going to buy it, just change the method by which you're going to do it. I really don't care which way you do it, but do not fail to move on the warehouse. It's a good buy for the state. It is an appropriate buy for the state, and it works. I will leave it to your good graces as to whether you want to charge the people who consume alcohol in this state additional funds for that privilege or whether you want to just average it out over time. Either way is fine with me, but I would encourage you not to get into a row and fail to act on it. It's an appropriate step for us to take, and it is a facility that meets our needs. I also am nervous about the action by the Joint Appropriations Committee on retirement, state retirement. As you know, over the last few years, we added significantly to the fund, about $75 billion, to help cover any shortfall that might be on the education side of that fund. We now, by virtue of the change in economy the status of the fund, there are issues which I think are going to compel us over time to require state employees to make a greater contribution to the retirement account. That portion, in terms of it being the ultimate outcome, I am comfortable with. What I am not comfortable with is a decision by the Appropriations Committee to proceed as quickly as they are. What I did in my budget was say, look, we're going to need more money. I'll set aside $48 million. We will figure out over the next year the right structure, the right mix between added funds from the state and added funds from the employees. Because remember, what we are doing is changing the way the employee contributes to it, which is not an improper move on our part. But there are some other assumptions that I think need to be evaluated over the next year. One is that ours is a fixed benefit plan, and we have had a habit of taking a fixed benefit plan and inserting cost of living increases. We need to assess whether that policy makes sense and whether we need to reevaluate the structure of the plan, and I also believe we need to carefully evaluate the role of the employee. The reason I set the $48 million aside is I believe it's going to need more money. But I think when you put more money in, you don't just do it because somebody kind of came in and said, oh, the world is ending. You say, okay, the world's ending, but what's our strategy to keep it upright? And I think we ought to have a strategy with the money and not just say we're going to head off and make a decision. This is a decision that has severe implications for current employees and retirees going forward. And I think one of the things that you cannot do is discuss this issue without settling on a policy one way or the other about cost of living increases. The impact is serious, and it is one that I hope you'll evaluate. I do not take grave exception with the proposition that state employees are going to have to pay more. What I worry about is that we've headed off on a strategy. We've headed off on action. We don't have a strategy, and we're talking about billion-dollar decisions here. And I think I would follow the old carpenter's rule, measure twice, cut once. On the other hand, the Appropriations Committee at the tail end, they had the saw out, and they were cutting whatever lumber needed to be cut so they could get out that day. So I hope we'll take another look at it. I want to talk quickly about the Health Department budget. The issue there continues to be Medicaid. Now, everybody says, well, we got the increase in FMAP from the federal government, and we did. Remember, the basic structure of Medicaid is 50% federal, 50% state. Feds have upped their share a bit. Now, that is more than offset by the fact that we had predicted about a 2.5% to 5% increase in enrollment in Medicaid. It turns out that it's closer to 8%, and we are ending up with a severe difficulty just keeping the thing on focus with the programs that we're funding today. We're about $300 million underwater. Let's just say roughly half of that is federal. Of the state half, $116 million of that is addressed through the reallocation of the FMAP money under the stimulus program. 26 of it is addressed by freezing reimbursement rates, and the rest of it's made up by a series of other funds. I alert you to this because a number of people who have come to me said, look, you've got extra money in Medicaid from FMAP. You do not. You do not have extra money. In fact, there's some question about whether it's going to be adequate to get us through. And in order to recognize that, you will see in the auditor's office we have set aside a reserve account, which has been supported by the Appropriations Committee, so that if we are wrong, we have some fallback funding to make sure that, in fact, we can continue to fund it. So be careful when people say, you've got all of this stimulus money out of the change in the FMAP, so fund my program. I need to tell you that it's already been allocated. It is already in use. And even with that, it may not be adequate to retain what's going on. The other uses for stimulus money have been the funding of major maintenance at the University of Wyoming and the community colleges. The way that money came to us, it allows us to allocate it, and it helps both of those all of those collective institutions fund major maintenance at a level that they haven't had for years. There's one element in both of those budgets that could turn out to be continuing expenditures depending on enrollment numbers. That's community colleges. We took $8 million of the stimulus money to address the increase in enrollment. In exchange for that, they had to forego any increase in tuition. Now, that could turn out to be an ongoing expenditure in the event that the enrollment numbers stay where they're at. Similarly, at the university, there's about $4 million over there that could turn out to be permanent. Other than that, the stimulus dollars have not been used on the basis of expenditures that could continue into the next budget cycle. So be careful when people talk to you about stimulus money. We may or may not have it. There's one other thing that I want to talk about in terms of the appropriations bill. I am not satisfied with the language in at least the early draft that I saw, and the final draft won't be available till Thursday. I'm not satisfied with the language in there to direct how we're going to do recalibration of school funding. As you know, from time to time, and in the last time I spoke with you, I got in trouble with part of the body by observing that I think we need to ask hard questions about our education funding. My position has not changed on that. But here's what I'd point out. Our opportunity to do that is at recalibration. Now, remember, recalibration is a phrase that has an import. According to Webster's Dictionary, to calibrate means to measure against a standard. To measure against a standard. The way we have approached recalibration in the past was, how much more money do we have to add? I don't believe we should do that. The way we should do this is to recalibrate our education funding against a standard. Is it producing the results that we expect? Our opportunity to do that is in the recalibration process. I would encourage that when that footnote comes through, that it be rewritten to give to whatever committee is going to do that up here the capacity to ask really hard questions and to get evidence-based answers about how it is we're spending money on education, what it is that it's producing in the classroom, and why it is that we're not getting a better result. We are in this state writing off at least 1 out of 4 and arguably 1 out of 3 kids in terms of ever completing their education, and we are also settling for far less in terms of the outcome of the scores that we should get, and our chance to address that is in the heart of this matter, which is in recalibration. A couple of items I want to cover that are non-budget. There are 4 bills that we've talked to you about with regard to wind energy. 2 bills relate to the Industrial Siting Act. One is a revamp of the Industrial Siting Act to make sure that it covers the kind of facilities that are being brought into the state. 2 reasons for that. One is to make sure that the facilities are properly regulated. The second reason is to make sure that the provision in the Siting Act that allows people who are dealing with those to get an extra bump in the sales tax, that is also in there. A second bill relating to the Siting Act contains provisions which essentially set county standards or minimum state standards, but give the county the capacity to have higher standards, but also gives the counties the capacity to defer that decision to the Industrial Siting Council should they want to. I would encourage you to look at both of those. 2 items which are controversial. One is my suggestion that we do a 1-year suspension of the exercise of condemnation for wind power collector lines. And I do this mindful of the fact that it is going to produce some significant controversy. But let me argue to this very carefully. The exercise of eminent domain by a private party is the exercise of a state authority granted to them by the legislature. It is a decision by the legislature to prefer one person's standing with regard to property rights over the other person. When they say to you, well, we don't use eminent domain, the truth is we have not used a nuclear bomb in this country since World War II. But the existence of the nuclear bomb has colored every discussion about international and national security. The same is true with regard to eminent domain. The fact that it is not used does not mean it is not a part of the conversation. And we need to think carefully about the extent to which we are going to put the state's thumb on the scale favoring one party over another in private property discussions. I'm not suggesting that be done away with forever, but I'm suggesting we take a 1-year hiatus. Legislatures create a committee, and we take a look at how eminent domain is going to work going forward. It is limited to collector lines, and it's limited to collector lines for a reason. Under the kind of lower range of possibilities in terms of development of wind resources in this state, you could have 1,500 miles of collector line. Under a higher range, and this is all kind of built around the 12,000 megawatt number, you could have 2,100 miles. What's the acreage? The acreage on the low range is 27,000 acres. On the high range, it is 40,000 acres that could be subject to collector lines, subject to the application of eminent domain. I think those parties ought to negotiate that on a free market basis without the state having its thumb. But I hope that you will consider that. Second item that is not related to industrial siting is this question of a tax. And it has drawn some controversy. And I will tell you the following. If you look at the wind energy industry, it is the most heavily subsidized industry in the country from the federal point of view. It is also an industry that enjoys its sort of energy choice of the day in terms of people saying, you know, it's important. And I don't quarrel with that. I mean, that's not my particular quarrel. It is something that has become very much the cachet source of energy, in part driven by a former vice president and then by the movie An Inconvenient Truth, that somehow wind is the answer. Wind is a really good answer for Wyoming. We have 40% of the best wind resource in America is located in Wyoming. It can be a remarkable industry for us. It can help keep people in agriculture. It can help keep people have jobs. And hopefully it can lead to some manufacturing facilities in the state. Having said all of that, they are not entitled to a free ride. This is the first opportunity that this state has had in my lifetime to actually diversify its tax base, to diversify our tax base. I can remember when this body, and some of the members are still here, actually ended up talking about whether we were going to do an income tax, because we did not have a diverse enough tax base. I would encourage you to think about this before you allow yourself to say, well, it's a political season, we want to do no new taxes. You know, you can explain it however you want, but at the end of the day, the decision you're confronting is, are you going to end up siding with the former vice president and his movie, or are you going to side with the county commissioners in this state, the people who need the money, the people who are dealing with the impact, and are you going to side with future generations who are entitled to have the opportunity to live in this state in a tax environment such as we have today. I would encourage you to think very hard before you reject this proposal. Now, after I made the proposal, suddenly people were willing to talk to us about it. So you may want to change it some. Some people have said, look, give the counties their share, let the state wait a while. That may make good sense, but I would encourage you not to walk off from this. Now, I've been through this with oil and gas. I've been through this with coal. Give you some idea how old I am, clear back to the 70s. And it's always the same thing. The industry hires a set of lobbyists, local folks that we know, who come in and say the world will end if you do this tax. Then pretty soon we get into the politics of it. Oh, my gosh, if you vote for a tax, the other side will use it against you in the election. I've been through this, and I've watched it, and every time when this body finally gets its act together, we do the right thing, which is we come up with a reasonable tax policy that says if you're going to do business in Wyoming, you're going to contribute to the well-being of Wyoming. You're going to contribute to the schools. You're going to contribute to the highways. Nobody gets a free ride. In the interim, we've got an awful lot of things that we're going to see. I have jokingly referred to the fact of the song and dance that I'm getting from the lobbyists, that the next thing you know, I'm going to see An Inconvenient Truth as a musical. It is... A little too subtle for you boys and girls. Think about what it is you're being asked to do. You're being asked to diversify the state's tax base. You're being asked to be reasonable with regard to the impacts on local government. And you're being asked to make a decision that says nobody in this state gets a free ride. I want wind energy. I believe it's good for the state. But it has to be on a term that is fair to the state and to the citizens of the state. I hope that you will consider those four bills. Couple of things that are real quick, although nothing's very quick with me. There is some legislation coming to you on carbon sequestration, House Bill 17. You know, I was in Washington, and they announced that they're going to have a big federal task force about carbon capture and sequestration. What I wanted to suggest to them is they skip their task force, came out and looked at what the Wyoming legislature has done, adopt it, and move on. It'll save us a lot of trouble. It'll save a lot of things that will go on in Washington. This body has led the country. And led the country proudly in figuring out how it is we're going to deal with carbon capture and sequestration, and I commend you for it, and I particularly commend those who have dedicated an immense amount of energy to sponsoring these bills. And the wonderful irony of that is that legislator who's been most dedicated to it is a legislator from the largest coal-producing county in America, which is our beloved Campbell County. In that same context, there is $45 million in the University of Wyoming budget for carbon capture and sequestration research. It is out of the ML funds. I know there's been some discussion about whether or not we should divert that to other ends. Do not divert that. We have made a commitment that will be matched by private money. These projects are probably going to run a legitimate test project on carbon capture and sequestration are going to run in excess of $100-150 million in order to test it. We need to be on the forefront. We need to demonstrate through the School of Energy Resources that carbon capture and sequestration works. It is vital to this country. It is vital to the future of Wyoming. And if you think about it, what we want to be able to do as a country is to demonstrate that these technologies work, and then we will sell these technologies to China and India instead of our always buying technologies from them. Let those technologies develop at the University of Wyoming. Support this effort and make sure that we are the ones who are selling those technologies overseas instead of buying them. As you know, juvenile justice has been an issue for me since I came to this position. There are two items that are before you. Senate File 9, Juvenile Detention Facility Standards, House Bill 12, Juvenile Detention Admissions Criteria. I urge your favorable consideration of both of those. Both of those are supported by the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association. They are supported by the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association. It is time that we had some degree of uniformity in this state about how we treat juveniles. As you know, we have taken $15 million of the stimulus money and allocated it to a series of juvenile detention facilities around this state in order to create options so that when we have people that have to be detained and are in a juvenile status, that they are someplace other than in hard lockdown with adults whose offenses far exceed anything we would like these young people to be around. One of the other ways to make sure that we are properly making decisions about incarceration and treatment is for you to support those two bills. They enjoy the support of the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association, and I hope they will enjoy your support. Property tax, a couple of things that are, I think, relevant. One is you've got an alternative appeal procedure that's going to be presented to you for county commissioners when they're acting in their capacity as County Board of Equalization. I urge you to adopt that. It is an option which would allow county boards, county commissioners, if they are desirous of not being in that capacity, that they can appoint people who would serve in that capacity, and that would allow for a continuation of, I think, better appeal processes, frankly. Some county commissions have a lot of time to devote to it. Others don't. And I would urge you to give that option to those commissioners. There is a decision that came out of the State Board of Equalization arising out of an evaluation question in Park County where they took exception to the actions by the assessor. The result of that was to take shovel-ready property, whether it is a housing subdivision or economic development property owned by a community, and subject them to a kind of full, not to a current value tax, but to a tax based on the most recent sale out of that lot. Here's what happens. Somebody goes out, develops a subdivision, they sell a couple of lots, Those lots then become the basis for the entire valuation of that subdivision, even if the market has changed, or if those lots currently couldn't sell for that amount. I would encourage you to adopt some legislation both for local economic development and for people who are developing property to be more fair with regard to how you value it. Reason simple. We keep complaining in this state that we don't have the capacity to get people to build housing. Yet when they develop a subdivision, get the sewer and water, and get it shovel ready for housing, we turn around and decide to tax them in a manner that makes it difficult for them to keep those lots in inventory so that they'll be ready for development. What we're going to do is we're going to discourage people from making the right decisions about the shape of a development in order to make sure that they make only the decision that is incrementally saleable, and I hope you look at it. Other item in the context of property tax, please, please make the statements of consideration public. For those of you who have heard from taxpayers who say, look, I can't figure out why my property is valued the way it is. I go down to the assessors, try to take a look at what the values are for other properties, and I can't see the statement of consideration. It seems to me that a taxpayer who is wanting to contest their tax payments has every right to know what is the valuation attached to another taxpayer's property. It is simply good government. And I think it's also fair to the taxpayer to let them see that. I also have a couple of economic development things I want you to consider. One is a sales tax incentive for data centers. Clearly, Wyoming has great power rates in terms of encouraging people to come here. What we lack is the capacity to compete on a broader field. And one of those areas where we're having trouble is that our sales and use tax is applicable to these data centers. Why is it important? data centers change out their equipment on a 3-year running cycle. So they look at it and say, look, if we can get in a position or a state or a locality where we're not paying that sales and use tax, it's worth quite a bit to us because it's not a one-time payment for them. They're moving that equipment out every 3 years. The two beneficiaries are primarily going to be Cheyenne and Casper. I don't want to be deceptive about that. There's some talk from time to time about data centers and other parts of the state, but the two most logical places based on power availability and communications are Casper and Cheyenne. But this is a way for us to encourage two things. It encourages diversification of the economy, but it also encourages in-state utilization of electric power, which is a good thing for us. It helps average out that base. There's also an economic development capital formation. You've seen this bill before. It's an offset against the insurance premium tax, hopefully to make capital available to small businesses in the state. Relates back to my earlier comment that one of the slowdowns in this country has to do with the availability of capital. I hope you will look at that bill. It'll be introduced in the House, and I hope you will consider it. We also have a need to address this issue on workplace safety. Three items, as you know, has come out of the task force. OSHA penalties, you'll get legislation offered to you to increase those. Interestingly enough, that legislation enjoys the support of many people in the industry. In fact, most of the industry is in favor of that legislation to increase the penalties. The second issue in that area is this question of seat belts. And I know that walking into this is walking into a briar patch because it's one of those issues where people say, I shouldn't have to wear a seat belt. There's going to be legislation offered to change the fine regimen to try to encourage people to use seatbelts. If you look at the data that was developed over the workplace safety effort, most, about 40% or 50% of those accidents are one-car rollovers to and from work where people weren't wearing their seatbelt. Now, I understand the political difficulty of talking about seatbelts. But, you know, in our house, the kids will tell you and my wife will tell you that the rule always was, if you're in the vehicle, you've got a seatbelt on. Vehicle doesn't move until the seatbelt's on. You know, and now, even today, you look to see, has everybody got their seatbelt on? So somehow, we're all willing to say it is the rule in our family. It is the law in each of our families of everyone sitting here. But somehow, we're afraid to say that it should be the law of the land that you pay a higher penalty if you don't have a seatbelt on. It's not an unreasonable thing. It's not an unreasonable thing to expect people to exercise responsibility and not just rights. We have to begin to realize that with the rights that we have in this country, there come some responsibilities. And it's not a big impediment, and I hope that you will look at that legislation. On the DUI matter, there are two bills, and one is in the House, one's in the Senate. They're both sponsored by friends of mine, and I am officially here to tell you that I support my friends. I just hope that one of those bills will make it to my desk. I learned long ago not to get between the Senate and the House, not to get between sponsors on bills. So I want both of the sponsors and their various supporters to know that I love you deeply, have grand affection, but hope that between the two of you, you can get me one bill, just one. And I think it is time. I mean, this question about alcohol and driving under the influence, it's absurd. And we should not tolerate it, and we should take whatever steps we need to take. I understand that it's difficult, but I hope that you'll take a look at those bills. I want to talk about a project that we're going to bring to you again, which is our health reform demonstration project. Does well in the House, or does well in the Senate, gets to the House and dies. It gets characterized as a creeping socialism on the third vote and ends up dying. I will hope that you will reconsider that. And I just want to talk fairly quickly. What we're asking people to do in this, and I don't believe it constitutes socialism, is to contribute something of their own to their own health insurance. That is, they have to participate. They have to participate. We're expecting them to be employed at least 20 hours. 20 hours in order to participate in this pilot project. We're expecting them to take responsibility for their own health. As all of you know, this question about cost containment is going to fundamentally come down to whether we take better care of our own health. We are not going to, in the event of a catastrophe, say, well, that operation costs too much and not try to provide it to our family. The only thing that's really going to affect cost is for us to affect utilization. The only way you affect utilization is by people taking more responsibility for their own health. The fourth thing that's in there is we expect them to follow doctors' recommendations. The project calls for people to be have greater access to their primary care physician. And what we're looking for are those things that drive the system in terms of cost. We're looking for early detection of diabetes. We're looking for early detection of cancer. We're looking for early detection of heart disease. Any of those elements that can become chronic diseases, we're looking for early detection. And in order to stay in this pilot program, they got to follow some of the doctor's advice. Which part of that, I would submit to you, is socialist? The part where we ask people to be responsible, the part where we ask people to pay for their own insurance, the part where we ask people to work. I encourage you to rethink this and take a shot at it. The other argument I reject is this notion that we have to wait for the federal government to address health care. If we wait for the federal government to address health care, most of us in this room will probably no longer be in need of health care. We will be on the other side of the grass. And maybe at the way, given the way they're addressing it, maybe that's not a bad outcome. But we cannot wait, and we should not wait. On one side, I just talked to you about how much health care costs are going up in terms of the impact on Medicaid, not just through enrollment, but through cost. On this other side, I'm talking to you about some things that might help us control that cost. Maybe not this year, but we've got to begin to demonstrate that, because in the long run, the society cannot afford to be paying 17 to 24% of every dollar in this culture for health care. We have to take more responsibility for it ourselves. I also want to talk to you about this question on a proposal I've submitted to you to ask for an amendment to the federal constitution to limit federal power. A couple of things I want to make clear at the outset. I do this advisedly. I mean, I previously sent up the standard resolution, you know, where we get to beat the desk and talk about it. And I've done that for years. I mean, I wrote speeches for Ed Hirschler when I was a young man, railing on the federal government. I wrote them for Mike Sullivan, and now I write them for myself. All of them have accomplished about the same as you'd expect. I've signed resolutions. I've done testimony. And here's where I end up, is that we need to go to the source of the problem. The source of the problem is the expansion of federal power. We can amend the state constitution. We can draft legislation. I can sign resolutions, and I'll be glad to do all of that with you. But it does not change the basic dynamic of the power of the federal government. The only thing that's going to change that is to address it in the organic document, which is the Constitution. Now, I'm not one of these people who's talking about secession from the Union. I think that the experiment of the United States is the most remarkable thing I've ever seen. You have 50 states, you have a common federal government, and we are in a remarkable country. I don't support secession. I don't support repealing the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Acts or any of the rest of it. What I'm talking about is some clear language that tries to reestablish the notion that this is a federal system, that there are states and there is a federal government. But there are states and we have prerogatives. I encourage you to consider it and consider it seriously. It is not something I take lightly. If I took it lightly, I would just have left it at the basic resolution that, you know, allowed me to rail against the federal government. This is far too serious at this stage. We are at a point where, whether it's No Child Left Behind or the latest set of rules I got on how you report domestic violence numbers, at the end of the day, the federal government is regulating nearly everything. Nearly everything. The states need to be more than empty vessels whose job is to execute federal policy. The states need to be more than empty vessels whose job is to execute federal policy. And the only way you're going to do that is to take very delicately, go in and try to reestablish the balance between the federal government and the states. Does it work? I do not know. I do not know whether this can get done. I propose that it be done in the same manner that the Constitution has been amended 27 times in our history, including the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights. I do not believe that we ought to have a constitutional convention. We have a process that works, and I hope that you will look at it and take it seriously. There's also a bill that will be intended, and I don't I say this mindful that the Chief Justice is going to speak here in a minute. I'm not calling the Supreme Court out. I want to make that clear. There is a decision that the Supreme Court made in which they identified two ambiguous terms in our statutes, and it had to do with the point of valuation. Under our law, properly so, a tie goes to the taxpayer. The statute was ambiguous. on the definition of how we would do point evaluation for gas plants. We have a bill in to address that, to reestablish what we had thought the law was and that people have paid taxes under for at least the last 20 years. And I hope that you will do that. And I submit it to you, not in disrespect to the court. I mean, the court made the right ruling, which is tie goes to the taxpayer. But we need to clarify that, and I hope that that you will do that. I also encourage you to think about, as you do the statute or as you do the budget, one last item, which is the there's language in there where we are trying to address the ongoing issue of distance learning and video conferencing. Distance learning and video conferencing. Issues that we have discussed and rediscussed at least for 10 years or longer. The proposal that's in the budget is that we would create a center of excellence at the University of Wyoming for distance learning, and that at the same time, a portion of the question of how we're going to do teleconferencing and communication around would also be moved to the university. Why am I doing it? It seems to me absurd that the governor of the state cannot, like any other business I go to, they can talk to people on video conferencing immediately. I can talk to my children in India on video conferencing. But I cannot talk and do not have the capacity to meet with the head of the Oil and Gas Commission in Casper or to meet with the director of Workforce Services in Gillette. We need to become much more serious about utilizing technology, in part because it saves money and in part because it saves time, and I think it makes a great deal of sense, and I urge you to support it. I want to offer a couple of last comments. One is I know that this has been long, that this a lot more issues than you wanted to hear about. But we have a remarkable opportunity because I think the budget is fairly straightforward. We have the opportunity to address some of these other issues, and I hope that you will. And as we gather here in an election year. And the question then on everybody's mind is how does this all sort out? None of us know. But what I think we should do is set all that aside and simply focus on the work that's before us. And where do you find the inspiration to do that? I think we find the inspiration to do that in the remarkable citizens of this state. I mean, I know that from time to time I get criticized about using the airplane and traveling the state, but I tell you there is nothing more wonderful and there is nothing more invigorating than traveling this state and talking to the people who are here. And they will talk to you, as you know, and they have lots of advice. And they, and you know, some of it's actually pretty good. Some of the advice where they're telling me where to go, I'd rather kind of disregard. But, you know, you watch the people of this state. They are dealing with contracting personal wealth. They are dealing with businesses where they don't have the kind of income that they used to have. They're dealing with laying off employees. They are dealing with the consequences of the recession in ways that should inspire us about how we handle our responsibilities as public servants, how we handle our duties to manage this budget. If we can manage our budget, as well as those citizens are managing their life, and dealing with the downturn in the economy, we will survive this, and we will be stronger, and we will be a better place for future generations. The issues that confront us outside the budget are serious issues. We have a chance to make some progress. We have a chance to make a statement about what we want Wyoming to look like in the future, whether it's on how we manage wind energy, which is probably the most significant force of change afoot in the state, or how we handle DWI. Each of those decisions that we make are statements about what we want the future to be like. What we want the future to be like for the next generation. For some of you, you're already talking about what it's going to be like for your grandkids. For some of us, we're still talking about what we want it to be like for our children. But we want them to have the opportunity that we have had. We want them to have the economy that we have had. And more than anything else, we want their life to be a bit better. We can leave this earth feeling good about what we have done if we have made sure that not only did we do no damage, but we made things better. Better for the next generation, better for those that we were around, and better for the great state of Wyoming. Thank you very much, and God bless you.
Governor Friedenthal, on behalf of the members of the legislature, I thank you for attending this joint session and for your message to us. Members of the 60th Legislature, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I now present the Honorable Martin Voigt, Chief Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, Governor and Mrs. Friedenthal, members of the 60th Legislature, elected officials, fellow judges, friends and fellow citizens, first thing I've got to do is break off from my prepared remarks and mention something. The governor sort of reminded me of it offhand. As you're all well aware by now, I'm not by nature a public speaker. And you've suffered through this several times now. But luckily for all of you, about 3 weeks ago, my wife and I and the governor and the first lady and where's Representative Korberg, at least, and some other people in the audience were all fortunate enough to attend an event in Thermopolis. And I learned something about public speaking at that event. And one of the things I learned is that you really cannot get your point across in less than an hour and a half. That works best if you're starting at about, 8:30 at night. I'll try to make the best of it. I know it won't work quite as well here at noon, but I'm going to try to follow what I learned there today. The other thing I'm going to say that's not in my prepared marks is, don't hold this against me. I have here a letter dated January 11th, 2010 from President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House inviting me to come here and do this. I don't just come over here. This will be my last appearance before you as Chief Justice. And I was going to hesitate there and wait to see if Senator Nicholas said, thank God, but he didn't. So I will go on. At any rate, my term expires at the end of June, and by the next time you're around here, there will be someone else doing this. And I leave the post with mixed emotions. I would like to tell you that I miss all the day-to-day decision-making and trauma and all the decisions that's made up so much of my life over the last 4 years. But the truth is, I really am not going to miss all of those things that took up so much of my last 4 years. And when I wrote this, I didn't realize my son was going to be here, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway. You elected officials and the governor and the legislature, I'm sure you all know exactly what I mean. I'm going to miss this kind of like the way you miss your kids when they go off to college. The other thing I wanted to tell you before I got into my remarks is that I probably should be in a little more awe of a body that can make it snow every time you come to town. People who are in charge of the weather are probably more important than what I've given you credit all this time. But as I was walking over here this morning in the snow, it reminded me of a couple of things. You know how you get all those emails with funny things in them? Some of them are funny and some of them aren't. Well, one of them was purportedly an email full of Jeff Foxworthy quotes that were, "You may live in Wyoming if." And I'm not going to read through the whole list for you. My favorite one was that if you carry jumper cables in the trunk of your car and your girlfriend knows how to use them, you probably live in Wyoming. I thought that was the best one. But I have one of my own that I made up. My family's sick of hearing it. But if you remember October when it snowed so bad, and mine is, if you use your lawnmower and your snowblower on the same day, you may live in Wyoming. There was one other one that has nothing to do with the weather, and I'll go ahead and throw it out there only because I have it written down. And that was that you may live in Wyoming if you measure distance by time. And that is, how far is it to Thermop? Oh, I don't know, about 5 hours. That's measuring it by time. You can work in the weather by saying, unless it's snowing, and then it's 3 hours to Casper, and you stay there. But I'll get into some real remarks now, and I'll remind you that I've got a little bit different task than what the governor has. His is called the State of the State, and this is called the State of the Judiciary. And so I ask myself for change, not what do I want to tell you, but what is it that you might want to actually hear about the judiciary? And I concluded that you probably wanted to know two things, and that is what we have been doing and what we plan to do in the judiciary. I'll start out with a few matters that seem to be a little mundane, maybe, but they're very important to us. I'll start out with some rules. As you know, we operate largely by court rules. What the lawyers have to do, what we have to do, what everybody has to do is by court rules. And this will come as a surprise to a lot of the judges and my law clerks up there, but I'm sort of a rule-oriented guy. And my goal was to make the court rules volume equal at least 3 volumes of the statutes before I was done, and I only got to 2. But I've been trying. So here's some of the things we've been doing. The rules of the Judicial Nominating Commission were amended to rid them of some antiquated provisions and to make the confidentiality sections more clear. In reaction to last session's replacement of the drug court statutes, we also adopted a set of rules governing judicial participation in court-supervised treatment programs. Now, that was not nearly as easy as it sounds, given the vast difference of opinion throughout the judiciary about treatment courts and the proper role of judges therein. After a lengthy study of the new national model code of judicial conduct, we adopted that very important set of guidelines with a few amendments to fit Wyoming statutes. Now, this next one's interesting. We also adopted 2 sets of rules governing access to court records and redaction of confidential information from court records. Now, in our innocence, and I should say in my innocence because this was mostly all my fault, or apparent ignorance, we thought these rules would be welcome because of the increasing risk of identity theft and the potential harassment of individuals identified in court records. Both due largely to the ever-expanding Internet and electronic access to information. The rules were intended to prevent access to personal information, particularly Social Security numbers, bank account numbers, and other financial information, dates of birth, home addresses. All of that seemed to us to be a worthy goal. But I took quite a shellacking in the newspapers. I received a thumbs down in the Casper paper for that legislation, and we received what I consider a moderately libelous editorial in the Cheyenne newspaper. what looked to us like protecting our citizens was described in the Cheyenne newspaper as, and I quote, "protecting participants in the legal process rather than serving the owners of the court system, the taxpayers of the state," unquote. The latter mentioned newspaper also opined that the rules, and I again quote, "show just how far removed the justices are from the people of this state," period, unquote. Once again, I said that's my fault. Apparently, from our ivory tower across the street there that you helped us build, thank you, we failed to see that the citizens of the state wanted to have that personal information made public. So, inasmuch as this is a citizens' legislature, we're going to start rectifying that here today. I thought perhaps that if you would each send me a letter revealing your Social Security number, your bank account numbers, your date of birth, your home address, we will list them on our website, and we'll start fixing this problem that we created with those rules. Maybe we can regain some of our relationship with the people of the state. I feel better already. I think this will lead to a great editorial in tomorrow's paper. Next, I'll mention some of the things that we started to fix but haven't yet gotten there. And I tell you because these things are on the horizon and you'll be hearing about them in upcoming sessions along the way. You are already familiar with the concept of electronic citations. You funded that program last year and then you reneged when the economy went south and we're going to start all over again. But it will be back soon, and I think it'll be again sponsored jointly with the Highway Patrol. Perhaps less interesting, but just as important on a daily basis within the judiciary are the following. And these are the things that I was talking about that we deal with on a daily basis. Number one, we need a branch-wide employee internet use policy, Stephen. Two, we need a branch-wide electronic data archives policy. Three, we need branch-wide video appearance rules. Four, we need branch-wide standardized rules governing allocation of payments received in criminal cases. Five, we need to address the antiquated and often misused position of district court commissioners. Six, we need to assess the role of court reporters and the potential use of digital recording. Seven, we continually need to assess the number and location of judges and magistrates. Eight, we need court interpreter standards and a regular fund from which to pay for interpreter services. Nine, we need to do a cost-benefit analysis of the judicial peremptory challenge rule, which rule allows either party in a civil case to remove the sitting judge without cause and requires the state to pay the travel costs of the replacement judge. And 10, and I see the clerks of district court lurking up there making sure I don't do anything wrong. This is true. It's on my plate. It's on somebody else's plate. We have to decide under Rule 77D of the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure who pays the postage when a clerk of court mails out copies of the judge's orders. I didn't put that first, but it's on the list. Should make it pretty obvious why I'm going to miss this job. I did very quickly want to mention some caseload statistics to you, just in case you're curious. Total circuit court filings increased from 175,613 in fiscal year 2008 to 184,435 in fiscal year 2009. As usual, most of those cases are traffic citations. In the district court, the number of total filings rose from 17,444 to 18,512. That latter number, coincidentally, is almost exactly the same as it was in fiscal year 2007. In both courts, civil filings are up while criminal filings are down. In the Supreme Court, we saw a slight decrease in appellate filings, down to 263 from 281 last year. I'm pretty sure, in fact, I'm almost positive that that's because the law is being made much more clear year by year, Governor, to make it easier for everyone to know what there is so there's no reason to appeal anymore. The real reason that I give you those statistics is to just let you know that there's no immediate need at this moment for judicial resource changes within the state that we know of. There may be some specific areas that you'll be asked to consider in the future, but not right now. Before I discuss a couple of legislative items, I want to tell you about recent personnel changes. No doubt you are aware that longtime District Judge Ed Grant retired from his post here in Cheyenne and was replaced by Circuit Judge Tom Campbell. For most of my career, Ed Grant has been the heart and soul of the district bench. There has never been anyone quite like Ed Grant in the tell-it-like-it-is category. No offense, Judge Campbell, but I'm afraid Ed might be irreplaceable. Judge Campbell's appointment to the district bench required the Judicial Nominating Commission to gear right back up for another nomination process. In August, the commission met to consider applicants for Judge Campbell's vacant circuit court position and sent three names to the governor. In September, the governor named local Cheyenne attorney Catherine Rogers to fill that spot, and she took the bench in November. Hitting a little closer to home for those of us, especially at the Supreme Court, was the retirement of our court administrator, Holly Hansen. Holly worked for the state of Wyoming for 30 years, 10 years with the Legislative Service Office, and 20 years with the court. She was court administrator for 11 years. Her value to the judiciary and to the people of Wyoming was incalculable. She seemed to know everything about every court, every judge, and every clerk, not to mention every legislator. She taught me all about interbranch cooperation. For instance, I no longer use the word demand or the word idiots when I come to the Joint Appropriations Committee. Those of you who know Holly know how much we miss her in that regard. Panic would have sent in the court except for one thing. Well, actually, I should say except for two people. On staff, we already had Deputy Court Administrator Joanne Odendahl, who has been with the court for 11 years and who worked in the executive branch for 17 years before that. In addition, we had as our program coordinator Rhonda Munger. Rhonda has been with the court for 13 years. Now, given all I just said about Holly, we made a seamless transition by naming Joanne as court administrator and Rhonda as deputy court administrator. Now, the Chief Justice is in name the administrator of the judicial branch, but you can probably rest assured that not only me, but nobody else can really keep up with all of that stuff. And we don't exercise much of that authority without conferring with those people, and we're going to continue in that regard in good hands with Joanne and Rhonda. Any of you who have worked with either of them know how lucky we are in that regard. Now, before I yield the floor, there are six additional matters to which I wish to draw your attention. First, a House bill is going to come before you, the purpose of which is to include court security officers in the definition of peace officer, as that term appears in Section 61104 and 72101 of the statutes. This bill will give our court security officer the authority to make arrests, and it will include the court security officer in the statute prohibiting interference with a peace officer. This change is essential for the safety and effective operation of that office. The second matter of particular importance to the judiciary is the funding contained in our budget request to continue the Uniform District Court Case Management System project. You'll recall that during the last session, you funded the initial implementation of this project, and we are now well into that process. With the funds already allocated, the tactical plan is in place, data conversion from the different case management systems has been accomplished, data standardization is being developed, pilot projects in Sweetwater County and Uinta County are planned to begin operations this month, and special juvenile court data handling is being created. Without continued funding, however, this project will come to a standstill, and the district courts will be left with a partially operational case management system. Electronic filing, the electronic transfer of cases from one court to another, and electronic record keeping are all still out there. Now, we have said to the district court clerks that we are from Cheyenne and we're here to help you. Please do not make that a hollow promise. That's why they're all up there. I want to quote what one district court clerk said to me about the process they're going through in this. This is a quote. The clerks of district court, along with the Supreme Court and other agencies, are working together with great unity to help make the Uniform Computer System a success. Now, I went to the trouble to quote that clerk because I wanted to make sure that you knew how much things have changed in the judiciary. If you are at all familiar with the system, you are aware that such cooperation was not always there in the past. The third matter requiring explanation comes before you as an exception budget request, but it is really just an historical oddity that these funds have not always resided in our budget. About a year ago, we became aware that many of our circuit court judges, rather than personally handling the judicial duties involved in the treatment courts, were delegating those responsibilities to hourly court magistrates. We had not been aware of the extent of that practice because we were not being asked to pay the magistrates, so nothing showed up in our records. When we decided that we needed to assess what the cost of the hourly magistrates was to the state, we learned to our astonishment and our embarrassment that they were being paid out of the treatment court program budgets, basically under contracts with the Department of Health. That simply is not right. For one thing, judges should never receive compensation from outside the judicial branch for the performance of their judicial duties. It can lead to many things, all of them bad, the worst of which might be confused loyalties. Second, The true cost of the state's judicial services is not accurately reflected if part of that cost is hidden in an executive branch budget. Consequently, this is not a request for new funds. It is simply a request that the funds used to pay hourly circuit court magistrates be housed in the appropriate location. We cannot police the use of hourly magistrates, and the true cost of judicial services is not shown in our budget if the magistrates are being paid contractually by another entity. Fourth, you will be asked to adopt legislation creating a statewide legal services program. Some background. In December 2008, the Wyoming Supreme Court, in cooperation with the Wyoming State Bar and on the recommendation of the Board of Judicial Policy Administration, created the Wyoming Access to Justice Commission. The commission was charged with identifying strategies to address the civil legal needs of low and moderate income people in Wyoming. In 2009, the commission studied the issue, held five public meetings around the state, and concluded that Wyoming should fund a statewide program for legal services. The proposed legislation will create a program funded through a $10 filing fee similar to the court automation fee. Wyoming cannot continue to rely upon federal funding for legal services. We believe the commission has made the case for funding the program as an obligation of this state toward its least fortunate citizens. So we ask for your aye vote on that bill. Fifth, two House bills, 37 and 00, and what's a resolution 004, will be presented to you asking you to place before the voters the issue of removing the state constitution's mandatory judicial retirement age of 70 years. Interestingly enough, that provision applies only to Supreme Court justices and district court judges, both of whom are constitutional offices, but does not apply to circuit court judges who are statutory judges. So when you passed the statute, you didn't put that 70 years in there. As the law now exists, men and women, still strong of mind and body, possessed of many years of training and experience that you paid for, must retire for no reason other than that they have reached an arbitrary age. There is no reason that voters in retention elections should not be the ones who decide who does and who does not remain on the bench. My sixth, and I love this word, my penultimate remarks, I had to look that up, will be about some serious problems facing the judiciary, not just here in Wyoming, but nationwide. As background, let me quote what Thomas Jefferson wrote to Thomas Paine in 1789. "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution." In the same year, he wrote to Abbe Arnaud as follows, quote, "In the form of juries, the people determine all controverted matters of fact, leaving thus as little as possible, merely the law of the case, to the decision of the judges." Those quotations fairly describe the intentions of the founding fathers when they recognized the almost sacred right of the jury trial in the structure of American government. Well, how does that sacred right look today? Commentators have begun to describe something called the, quote, disappearing jury trial. Fewer and fewer civil jury trials are being held across the country in both the federal and state courts. Expense and untimeliness are the chief culprits. Ironically, these ailments have largely been self-induced. Over the years, in an effort to simplify procedure and to place trial focus on identified issues, thereby speeding things up and supposedly making the system more user-friendly, we, meaning the judicial system, replace the old stultified code pleading with notice pleading. We standardize operation via the adoption of one-size-fits-all rules of procedure, and we developed a pretrial discovery process meant to eliminate the element of surprise from jury trials. A recent study by the Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System, housed at the University of Denver, produced the following conclusions. One, notice pleading is too vague and it leads to too much pretrial discovery. 2. Pretrial discovery has become an end in itself, and it no longer promotes just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of actions. And 3, procedural rules should be specialized to promote the natural development of particular types of cases. In short, the civil jury trial system is broken. Now, why am I telling you these things? Because Wyoming is not immune. We have the same pleading issues and the same discovery abuses as does every state, and we have the same problem with the disappearing jury trial. One local district judge here in Cheyenne told me about a month ago that in the past 5 years he has presided over about 20 criminal jury trials, but only 2 civil jury trials. That is here in Cheyenne. That's one of our metropolises. It is my belief that if we are going to maintain the judiciary as a legitimate third branch of government, if we are going to fulfill the Founding Fathers' vision of the sacred role of the jury trial, we have got to address some of these issues. What good is a right to trial by jury if no one can afford a jury trial and it takes 3 years to get in front of the jury? What good are rules of procedure and discovery if they turn a simple divorce case into a financial and psychological nightmare? Why are mediation and arbitration so popular? Why would anyone prefer to get his justice from some tribunal held in the back room of a Holiday Inn rather than from the courts? Because we are too slow and we are too expensive. Now, the biggest challenge to the judiciary in the near future may be facing and conquering these problems. I am not now asking you to do anything. I bring this to your attention because it is a necessary comment upon the state of the judiciary. It is my sincere hope that chief justices in the future will have better things to report in this regard as we in the judiciary take the initiative to tackle the problem. I'm sorry about the sermon, but it's my last shot at the bully pulpit, and I wanted to use it here to that advantage. Now, to finish up, I'm going to confuse those of you who know me well by admitting here in conclusion that I am not by nature an optimist. It's easy for me to doubt. It is easy for me to find fault. It is easy for me to question the motives of others. I never win the Miss Congeniality contest in the annual bar polls. I don't even come close. I say all that because I want you all to know how sincere I am when I echo the words that Chief Justice Hill said 4 years ago. I now have the best job anyone could ever hope to have. I want to thank the people of Wyoming for giving me this opportunity to serve them. Now, beyond that, I want to tell you, the members of this body of the legislature, what a pleasure it's been dealing with the body of distinguished men and women who are here. You have not always agreed with the court. You have not always given the court what it wanted. Yet there has never been any doubt in my mind as to your good faith, your commitment to what is best for the people of Wyoming. And I want to personally thank you for that. Thank you.
Justice Voigt, on behalf of the members of the legislature, I thank you for attending our meet, this joint session, and for your message. Senator Cole and Representative Buchanan and Goggles, will you please escort the governor from the chambers? Senator Burns and Representative Langdon and Kimball, will you please escort the Chief Justice from the chamber? Mr. Speaker, I thank you and members of the House of Representatives for being our hosts this morning. Mr. Majority Floor Leader Anderson.
Mr. President, I move that this joint session be dissolved.
Senate Minority Leader Session.
Mr. Senate President, I second the motion.
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion is carried. Senate Majority Floor Leader Anderson.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate be in recess until 2 p.m.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Senate is recessed until 2 p.m.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader Buchanan.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House be in recess until 2 p.m.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The House is recessed until 2 p.m. Thank you.